This is a production of Cornell University.
I'm the director of the Society for the Humanities, but pretty much everybody here knows that. Probably like everybody here knows what a pleasure and honor it is for us to have Professor Verena Andermatt Connelly here from Harvard University. This is an invitational lecture for the Society for the Humanities Senior Scholar in Residence, that being Professor Connelly. And I should say that her visit here has a long prelude, and the first prelude began in Switzerland, where she led a very tranquil life on the shores of Lake Geneva before she invaded the United States, where she did her PhD in comparative literature in French at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. This building has a very strange trajectory between Madison and Cornell. Evidenced by the Carolyn Biddy Martin dining room right now. Now a professor of comparative literature and romance languages and literatures at Harvard. Verena exerts her leadership over culture and the arts as master of Kirkland House at Harvard. She's also taught at Miami University, the University of Paris 8, University of California, Berkeley, and UCLA. We all know her to be a very prolific translator and scholar. It's fair to say that Verena was almost single-handedly responsible for bringing French feminism to the United States, not only through her translations of Hélène Cixous, our A.D. White professor at large, but also through her monograph on Hélène Cixous, Writing the Feminine. She also published on behalf of the Miami Theory Collective in 1994, the collection Rethinking Technologies, whose essays by the likes of Félix Guattari and Catherine Hales, who was here this weekend, really reopened the discussion of the relationship of technology to philosophy, to electronic culture and capital. For my money, it remains to be probably the most informative and most acquisitive volume on new approaches to the technological that we have. I think it's still in print, even. It's being reprinted by the University of Minnesota Press. It's being reprinted. Since that time, Verena Connelly also has become a leading voice in, I guess what we could broadly say, eco-poetics. Through her monograph, especially through her monograph, Ecopolitics, The Environment and Poststructural Thought, which is a spectacular book. If you hadn't had the chance to read it, it really opens up new intersections in the relationship between ecology, philosophy, promises and perils of poststructuralism in relationship to what it offers and might not yet have delivered vis-a-vis the ecological. It's a fantastic book. And her the book of all books that I highly recommend that all of you read as soon as possible, The War Against the Beavers, Learning to Be Wild in the North Woods, which reflects on her combative life in her summer cabin near the Boundary Waters wilderness area of Minnesota. In French, Verena has also published Littérature politique et communisme, Lire les lettres françaises. She's written widely in cultural studies, art criticism. I noticed has a new essay forthcoming in a new collection on Deleuze and queer studies. And she's been just a remarkable presence amongst our fellows. We welcome her generosity, her warmth, her friendliness, and her critical acuity. And so thank you very, very much for speaking to us on, now I've forgotten the title, Spatial.
You haven't started yet, in fact, it's a very vague and purposely vague title. It is a very broad title, Spatial Fictions. Thank you.
thank you, Tim, and thanks everybody for coming. And since this is almost the end of the stay for me here, I would like to take this opportunity to thank everybody, thank Tim for the invitation, thank the Society for the Humanities, and just to say how much I've enjoyed my semester. It was extremely productive, and it was wonderful hearing everybody at noon today, so all these ideas that are circulating in my head. So really my pleasure to be here. One letdown, perhaps, is that this paper, I have multiple deadlines coming together this week and have been very harried and harassed. So spatial fiction has nothing to do with water. There are two allusions. I have a manuscript that I completed on spatial fictions. It's not even that, because I would have had to change it around, but it is something that I sent off yesterday before it comes back again, and that has to do with a new literary history in France, and in French, that is called Global France. And my colleague and friend Mitchell was supposed to be in it, but he pulled out. So I did not pull. I didn't dare to pull out because it's done. It's, you know, it's edited by my colleagues. And so my piece is really for that volume. It's a piece that has to do with air more than with water. And I mean air because it's written at very high altitude. So it is very general. But I hope nonetheless that we can discuss, that it will lead to some discussion. I had a little paragraph that would tie it into water, and then that's the end of water. So I said, in France, because Tim asked me to write a paragraph. I said, in France, as in other Western and non-Western countries, economic networks develop in the matrices of electronic technology. What is called their streams, flows, and barriers, dams, draws the very image of their imaging from a host of water metaphors. If in our seminar, water is a critical concept for the humanities, the metaphors that carry our imagination of global traffic and passage assist us in linking worldwide dilemmas concerning water as depicted in the recent movie Flow, and that's what I wanted to do it on, but we don't live in the best of all worlds, to demographic movement. In this paper, I'd like, however, indirectly to link issues of migration to water metaphors through attention to the containing vessel called the nation state. Flow of digital images, flow of capital, flow of people. Through a reading of Etienne Balibar and others, I would like to argue that population movement had a lasting impact on the nation-state, subjectivity, and citizenship, on a discipline that is, in fact, tributary to the imagination of fluvial passage, French and Francophone literature and culture. The contention is that contemporary French culture is diverse and vibrant. It no longer comes in pure or filtered works of art or writing, but in mixed genres, hybrid and recombined forms, thanks in no small way to digital process that explode a narrow affiliation of nation and literature. So this is my introduction, and here is the paper. So again, it's a circumstantial paper and has certain constraints. What do we mean by global France? Is it the presence of Carrefour shopping centers in every Asian city on the Pacific Rim, the global circulation of products of LVMH under the watchful eye of its CEO Bernard Arnault, or the presence of Total's oil rigs planted off the shores of the ex-colonies of Africa? France is often dismissed in the American media for opposing globalization, a synonym in the minds of many a Frenchman, such as a former activist, José Bouvet, of the Americanization of the planet. Globalization is generally equated with quasi-instant electronic communication, as well as with the circulation of commodities and the borderless flow of finance. However, as a result of decolonization as well as economic globalization, a much increased flow, not only of money, but of bodies, also circulates all over the world. How does all this affluence emanate from France in our global age, and where does it go? In France, as in most Western and non-Western countries, worldwide electronic and economic networks and resulting population movements have had long-lasting impact on the nation-state, subjectivity and citizenship, as well as on French and Francophone literature and culture in general. a French literature and culture, a somewhat mythic concept that expresses the essence and the soul of the nation, has given way to American-style media culture, but also to diverse and transnational cultures that are produced in and from France. Did I tell you that this volume is on global France? So it's, I did tell you that, okay. So that's why you get a lot of that. We could easily begin by showing that what for the last century and a half came to be called French national culture has always been, in the plural, the product of many encounters and intersections. Migrations among provinces, countries, and kingdoms existed in the Middle Ages. The advent of oceanic travel pushed borders away from Europe. The Sun King watched tragedies inspired by Greek sources, and the great French novelists and philosophes of the Enlightenment were in dialogue with English writers and philosophers familiar with the New World. Even before decolonization, established French presses published, albeit selectively, Caribbean, North African, and African writers, who were, as the Algerian writer Rachid Boujedra reminded his audience during a recent talk, heavily inspired by surrealism, but also by American literature, especially William Faulkner. In the 1960s, after a century of long and often violent efforts by the bourgeoisie to produce a homogeneous French nation, a self-enclosed entity defined by the illusion of a unified and unifying culture based on the exclusion of others, a number of writers and theorists and artists, many of whom, like Hélène Cixous, Julia Kristeva, and Svetlana Todorov, came from outside France, founded or developed literary journals that focused on the poetics of texts rather than on national literature and literary history. Among these journals were Tel quel, Poétique and Littérature. Hélène Cixous, one of the driving forces of Poétique, declared that writers and theorists from around the globe were in proximity with each other across genres as well as spatial and temporal boundaries through their writerly treatment of similar dilemmas such as the articulation of life and death. To a mentally and physically polluted country with lingering memories of colonialism and Vichy, they preferred literary spaces of resistance and invention. Like beacons, in the words of Hélène Cixous, these writers communicated with one another and used their common vigilance to fight against social and political injustices. Indeed, since World War II, but especially since the 1960s, space became a critical concept at the very moment when the writers and theorists noted above felt compressed under the impact of technologies and of what was still thought to be the disciplinary bourgeois state. They remain critical of the administrative state as well as of the term nation, with its connoted emphasis on an always phantasmatic homogeneity and unity. Sensing changes taking place, and without always being able to fully articulate them, these writers and thinkers focus on poetics, but also on a return to the everyday, away from monumental history. They emphasize everyday spatial practices that undermine the bureaucratic authority. They consider official national literature to be the handmaidens of an all-encompassing rational thought in the service of the state that permeates life and ultimately immobilizes it in a state of rigor mortis. In the parlance of Gilles Deleuze and Félix Guattari, striated spaces that have lost their flexibility need to be made smooth, and so too microspaces to be opened in the state's macrospaces to make possible other ways of thinking. Critical attention to everyday spatial practices, which function without regard to state-imposed administrative networks and indirectly question modernist strategies of industrial society that fostered colonialism, are the subject of Henri Lefebvre, of Michel de Certeau, period. It is also the domain of Jean-Luc Godard, a poetic and political filmmaker who, indulging in theoretical Lefebvre and literary Faulkner allusions, explored in Deux ou trois choses que je sais d'elle, Two or Three Things I Know About Her, in 1966, the effects on people following the imposition of a spatial order and the creation of the first grands ensembles, massive suburban apartment complexes in the outskirts of Paris, built to relocate French workers from insalubrious conditions and to repatriate the Pieds Noirs, the French Algerians who left North Africa after 1962. Godard shot his film at the Cité des 4000 of La Courneuve, not far from the Aubervilliers train station through which tourists now shuttle without stopping on their way to and from Roissy Airport. One memorable sequence features a male and a female facing each other in profile, their heads not covered with straw a la T.S. Eliot, but zipped up in two traveler's bags, one blue, bearing the Pan Am logo of the Globe, and the other red, the bold letters of Trans World Airlines. Through this image, and if I were up to date, Celeste asked me if I had images, and I don't. It would greatly enhance this, but you have these two people with the bags over their head walking, you know, and with a beautiful picture of a transatlantic encounter of a map in the back. Through this image and others, Godard asks, when not only the state, but a growing media culture imposes icons of the globe upon inherited literary and cultural values, how can one reinvent and make more habitable the city spaces in which they are shown? Many texts and films of this period ask how to recover an existential territory, be it mental or physical, or even more, how to open spaces that would defy an increasingly abstract system of signs born with the acceleration of technologies, engineered by the state and then by the ideology of trans-world consumerism. By way of their fictional and critical writings and films, Sixou, Lefebvre, Certeau, Godard, and others urge their readers and viewers to reappropriate space through language and new types of bodily practices. In La Genée, the newly born woman, see, I never stray far from Hélène Cixous, after all, doesn't get away. Cixous brackets a repressive and colonial-minded French state by espousing a series of combative texts foreign to the French national canon of chauvinistic quality. However, in a long dialogue with Catherine Clément at the end of the co-authored book, Cixous voices pessimism for the future in an era opening to marketing and consumerism. And I quote, "There is, in a very generalized manner, a loss of voice in the world of writing, of literature, of creation. So that means that all the governments united, whether right or reformists, are saying, if you still have eyes, shut them, and intellectual of all countries, your mouth, and don't start making analyses. And besides, it isn't worth the trouble. One sees the development of an international intrigue that is leading toward capitalist imbecilization in its most inhuman, most automatic, most formidable form. The selling out of all countries, the handing themselves over the way France had done with the United States, is also done on condition of a complicitous silence," unquote. Slowly, there came a realization among these writers and critics that the bureaucratic state itself was transformed with the advent of American-style consumerism, based on international finance, another type of economy restructured French society. It will reach an apogee under the impact of electronic technology and the global reach of media, which Roland Barthes already demystified in some of his essays in Mythologie. What was perceived as the loss of life with the vanishing of traditional spaces and the emergence of a new social hierarchy are mockingly deplored in Jacques Tati's films such as Mon Oncle, which juxtaposes the lively scenes of the uncle with his friends at the local market and in the cafe where people sing and play music with the sterile existence of a family in the ultra-modern house replete with the latest technological gadgets. In Playtime, all that remains of traditional neighborhoods is a lone flower vendor who has become the object of photography by tourists in search of a lost everyday Paris. The city itself has mutated from a mass of five-story buildings under a steel-gray sky into a kaleidoscope of transparent glass buildings in which everyone is under electronic surveillance. The symbolic cityscapes from the Eiffel Tower to Montmartre are reduced to reflections in glass doors. And we could find the same in others that I will not mention, not develop here, like Simone de Beauvoir, for example, and Georges Perec. Arguing along inherited Cartesian lines in Le Système des Objets, Jean Baudrillard observed that consumerism transforms symbolic bourgeois spaces, the repressive sides of which had been the object of intense feminist scrutiny. When, with market culture, interiority and depth, thought to be the personal space and warm hearth of the individual self, give way to exteriority, a certain freedom to invent space follows. A previously vertical order becomes more horizontal, though new hierarchies based on money quickly reappear. Baudrillard will declare later that with what he calls the new global tendency, introduced by a consumer-style economy, a return to the everyday was a dead end at a time when the aim of capital was to eradicate symbolic spaces and to establish in their place more functional counterparts. The perceived collapse of existential territories was indeed symptomatic less of the refinement of state control than of another then as yet unnameable condition of global consumerism. In retrospect, it can be said that the intellectual movements questioning the ethos of the French state of the 1960s coincided with this very transformation. With globalization, which might actually be qualified as a second globalization, the first being that of transatlantic encounters in the 16th and 17th century, and without counting that of communism, which tried to impose the same language everywhere, France underwent the same transformations as most other Western industrial countries. Formed by the Revolution of 1789 and the colonial enterprise in the following century, the French state in the 1960s witnessed a weakening at the hands of transnational companies and what Jean-François Lyotard, in his political writings, called the arrival of big money. France was soon called upon to deal with this reconfiguration and to protect its own citizens against a loss of rights at the very same time that it was summoned to address another major shift taking place through massive migrations from the country's ex-colonies, as well as from Eastern Europe and Asia and other parts of the world. With globalization, migration, and the constitution of the European Union, France began to change to the point where today critics in the line of Étienne Balibar ask whether France is still recognizable as a separate country or whether it is simply a border against the Southern Hemisphere. Balibar even goes so far as to ask, provocatively, whether not only France, but Europe itself is still recognizable as a continent or whether it too has simply become a border. In this new context of technological acceleration, economic globalization, extensive population movements, and the progressive withering and transformation of the nation state, what happens to French literature and culture? Leaving aside for the time being the question of consumerism, the media and technologies, and focusing more on the effects of population movements on culture, we can ascertain that the unraveling of an earlier French state thought, as Paul Virilio put it, with its classical ideals and embodied in many literary histories grounded in positivism, which began in the 1960s with a new focus on literary and cultural spaces, is now complete. A post-Enlightenment and post-revolutionary style universalism that paradoxically had led to often repressive politics of assimilation is no longer possible. Neither is a humanism that asserts the existence of a universal human condition. A national culture that from the immediate post-war years to the 1960s had rather unquestioningly assimilated in its canon the likes of Beckett, Camus, Ionesco, Sarraute, even Cixous and Derrida, has come under renewed scrutiny. Beckett is now celebrated, dear me, as the greatest Irish writer, while Camus' L'Étranger has been criticized for its transparent treatment of man's condition that is blind to a colonial setting, estranging the action from an ambiguous homeland. Cixous and Derrida rediscovered their Algerian roots through their difficult relation to French language and literature. Over the last few decades, these very writers and theorists have gradually shifted their focus away not only from universal human dilemmas, but also from pure poetics, toward the exploration and re-elaboration of their transnational ties. These ties, more and more numerous, open the French nation state and its culture to the outside. They also transform them from the inside. In fact, they undo the very possibility of a binary division between inside and outside with the advent of a networked world. However, Although a global world may seem borderless, and many writers and intellectuals such as Jacques Derrida in On Cosmopolitanism and Forgiveness dream of a cosmopolis to come, people are still defined and will be for some time in relation to a nation state to which they belong or in which they do or would like to reside. These new dilemmas and tensions within the country's borders inflect the production of culture. The notion of community, heretofore dismissed as a pre-revolutionary phenomenon, recently appeared in Republican France. Communities help produce what is far from a once ingrained ideal of a homogeneous national culture, and even from that of a world culture that the media purveys in its news and advertising. They consist of people of diverse ethnic, religious, or even national origins who often have ties that reach far beyond French borders. Through these communities, the very concept of the nation state, bearing a renewed emphasis on subjects and citizens, is being further reassessed. Consequences are manifold. On the one hand, the country's borders, more porous than ever, enable easy passage for money and for certain people from the European Union and from elsewhere. On the other, new visible and invisible borders are erected inside the country in the form of racism and economic discrimination. In the French state, as it is defined by Republican and administrative language, a sudden obsession with things national comes forward at the very moment when the term nation transmogrifies under the impact of migration. In addition, since 2001, outer borders are becoming tighter again amidst threats and phantasms of terrorism. Of importance for many writers and theorists is an active decoupling of the nation and the ideal of blood and soil from the state, human and citizens' rights, and a transformation of the latter so that it reflects the changes taking place. Between the new communities with their increasingly numerous transnational links that make up the contemporary French state, no simple continuity is discernible. In 1985, Michel de Certeau, echoed more recently by Étienne Balibert, made it clear in a couple of essays on ethnic encounters published posthumously in English in a volume entitled The Capture of Speech, that some codes, such as fashion, food, and music, travel easily. Their mobility has led to a hybridization of cultures, although, as Certeau cautioned, the latter generally is but a thinly disguised hybrid monism, that is, a unified, often dominant discourse exploited by the media that only simulates diversity. Other codes, however, especially those pertaining to symbolic issues such as sexuality or gender, marriage, life and death, are more resistant. In spite their erosion through media culture, these issues bear unconscious residues that have not entirely disappeared. They are at the very core of much contemporary literature, theory, and film produced in and from France. Writers from the various communities residing in France may have recourse to French in order to criticize repressive aspects of their own culture. For example, Rachid Bougiras' The Repudiation, or more recently, Nina Bourrahi's Forbidden Vision, deal critically with questions of sexuality, women, and gender in Muslim communities. More numerous are those who, from their communities in France, residing as French citizens from Algeria or Senegal, rather than from Provence or Burgundy, write about problems confronting French society. Balibar calls these voices France's alterity. It is perhaps not so much a question of alterity, a term that is too binary for a networked world that puts in question such a division, but of a culture produced in the contemporary state of France that is more and more splintered from the idea of nation. France today consists of various communities. It is the writer's responsibility to produce fictions that are active translations and ongoing negotiations between them. In his studies of classical France, Michel Foucault sensitized his readers in the 1960s and 1970s to the power of taxonomy. While texts written in the French idiom in other countries of the world, often those of France's ex-colonies from the Maghreb to sub-Saharan Africa, can be classified as francophone texts, those produced in France are part of the country's culture. An attempt to classify them separately marks a form of voluntary or involuntary exclusion. To separate texts written from other communities within Francophone, as it is often done in American curricula, is to refuse to acknowledge that the French national culture, as it had been envisioned in the 19th and early 20th centuries, has de facto ceased to exist. In other words, literature produced by these voices, by the voices of these communities, cannot be treated as distinct from a French literature and culture. These voices may or may not be in dialogue with others outside a country's distant and have distant transnational ties. They are hybrid, but also plural and of diverse tenor. They are, in any case, far from homogeneous. In such a climate, it is no longer possible to heed a single dominant voice, such as that of Jean-Paul Sartre, who may have well been the last heroic and indeed universal French intellectual. In the global and multipolar world, what Bruno Latour derides repeatedly as the cargo dreams of transcendence that conservative thinkers like Luc Ferry are so intent on reviving are no longer possible. A new universalism focuses less on the metaphysical problems experienced by all of humanity, among them Sartre's and Camus' ideas of transcendence, than on the existing and on the existence of conflicting, even competing, universalities in the French state, the European Union, and in world space. Even if problems today are similar around the world, geography, history, and geopolitical contexts give a particular profile and an angle on culture, cultures that are both local and transnational. If writers and theorists of the 60s first wrote against state-sanctioned spatial compression by mobilizing literary spaces or by using tactics to prevent the disappearance of everyday spaces, under what they perceive to be technologies in the service of the state, those writing at the cusp of the 21st century shift their emphasis to engage in an urgent elaboration of what Balibar calls un nouvel espace, a new space, both mental and physical, in which borders are undone and new articulations created among communities and even countries. In an ongoing effort to translate cultural specificities always with a remainder, these writers actively engage in the construction of new spaces, not only in France, but also in Europe and in the world at large. Unlike their Anglo-Saxon counterparts that are more prone to mediation, writers from migrant communities in France have inherited a long-standing Republican militant tradition that they are turning to productive ends. We can ask at this point whether traditional cultural means such as literature, film, are even capable of dealing with problems of a magnitude that face France and the world today. Current social, economic, and political dilemmas that cannot be separated from globalization are quite different not only from those Sartre had outlined, but also from those that preoccupied the founders of Telle Quelle, Poétique and Littérature, who undid national literature in the service of bureaucratic machinery, including that of the university, the site of intense interrogation and of active political ferment, by means of international poetics or even identification with those who sought to combat the state by way of spatial practices. Today, from their communities, contemporary writers are dealing with social and political problems that are the result of decolonization and economic globalization, and no less with consumer culture, and increasingly the fortunes of literature and culture in the context of electronic communication. It may be symptomatic that no poet or literary figure in French has emerged in the early years of the millennium to lead the charge of an intellectual brigade, as had the either great existentialists in the 1940s or the avant-garde and the post-structuralist elite of the 1960s and 1970s. Writers and intellectuals have been miniaturized, as Bruno Latour once more puts it jokingly. Their books are made available on easily reproducible compact discs in a global context where center and periphery are obsolete points of reference. They circulate in networks that may or may not intersect with one another. Cultural activity gets dispersed in smaller units. how to reappropriate vanishing existential territories becomes less important than how to live and move diversely in these multiple networks. Less prone to hold on to universal belletristic ideals, these new spaces are more directly politicized. They aim creative energies toward a reshaping of inner and outer borders, whether mental or concrete, under mounting global pressure. For this purpose, it can be said that genres themselves have been hybridized. Faced with acceleration through technologies and commercialization of much literature and film, with the production of media intellectuals and writers, the critical essay of limited circulation, often in dialogue form, has taken on renewed importance, as have written or filmic documentaries and a certain militant theater that deals with current political issues. Commentaries and theater and theories of shorter half-life replace the more ambitious and from its onset always already unfinished novelistic project of Sartre's The Roads to Freedom, but also of those of the avant-garde literature and so-called high theory of the 1970s. Contemporary critical essays of ephemeral and temporary fracture ask, in Balibar's terms, burning questions in new and complex ways. They are written from what the philosopher calls lieux de fiction, sites of fiction. They are not only literary intentions, but constructions based on knowledge and experience that include an unconscious. They produce a real that always contains a fictional dimension. At stake in these essays is the construction of common spaces. Written by those who live or have lived in France, they include, for example, I'm just giving you a few examples, Guattari's Three Ecologies, Deleuze's Negotiations, Derrida's On Cosmopolitanism and Forgiveness, or Latour's The War of the Worlds, What About Peace? All these writers and theorists produce their fictional spaces that concern problems of the nation state, subjectivity, citizenship, the media and marketing, as well as what it means to exist in a multipolar national and world space and how to live along a cutting political edge. Others, like Azouz Begab, are written from immigrant communities refusing racist reductions of ethnicity. Somebody like Begag fights to give voice to individual immigrants and to bring their experience of the city and the country to the eyes and ears of a sympathetic public. Still others, written by political refugees, and here we have people like Assia Djebar, who writes in French, now resides in the United States, and weaves different writerly voices in her narrative webbings, such as Blanc d'Algérie, the Algerian white, in order to denounce current social and political injustices in Algeria and negotiate new, less violent ways of being in common. So all these writers express similar cultural problems from different angles, and by way of their critical negotiations, they create an ever-changing French culture. And I have some more examples here. Such is also the recent attempt of what we can call docu-fiction. We can think of François Maspero's and Anaïque France, a writer and photographer who, in the documentary fiction Roissy Express, Journey into the Suburbs of Paris, tried to give a voice and a face to many humans making up the heterogeneous communities that compose France today by stopping at the various train stations between Paris and Roissy, such as Aubervilliers, and like Certos practitioners of the everyday, Maspero and Franz, they literally walk and talk and let others speak and even invent their poems, which is an important dimension, and also create their theater. The distance between these docufictions and the filmic and textual narratives of the 1960s can be seen when juxtaposing Godard's in retrospect magisterial Two or Three Things, I Know About Her, with a little-known documentary film by Patrick Lebel, Notes pour Debussy, Lettre ouverte à Jean-Luc Godard, Notes pour Debussy, open letter to Jean-Luc Godard, and I don't have to translate, who appeared in Godard's 1966 film as Bouvard, a Flaubertian character mindlessly reciting titles of piles of videos, challenges what he perceives as the Swiss filmmaker's univocality in his filming of the Grands Ensembles, period. In his own fictionalized documentary, Lebel revisits the same building, ironically bearing the name from classical culture, the Debussy of the 4000 in La Courneuve. Contrary to Godard, in a style that is more than cinéma vérité or simple witnessing, Lebel invites the inhabitants of different communities from the housing estate to produce their own narratives. By enabling the telling of their stories and the inventing of new ones, Lebel helps the residents engage in an act of resistance and of creation. Residents participate through word and deed in the construction of a new French space, this nouvel espace that Balibar and others argue for in their writings, which the collective creation of a colored wall mosaic at the end of the film makes clear. The pieces of the mosaics are like pixels of digital photography that, contrary to its analog counterpart that reproduces a pre-existing reel, make possible an ongoing composing and recomposing of images. With a proliferation and interweaving of voices, with no outside, critics, filmmakers, and writers put themselves on stage. They become one voice among many. They are no longer interpreters of an object, but mediators. And I was thinking of this Patricia Zimmerman when she was here. She had an expression: they bring in, they don't push back, you know. So between Godard and Lebel, you would have the bringing in and the pushing back. And there seems to be in all of these docufiction an effort to bring in. And for this bringing in, we could even cite Hate, for example, which tries to give voice and a face to the inhabitants of a neighborhood. And in Kasavitz's published script that led to the film, the published script contains photographs by a certain Gilles Favier, and the photographer doesn't reproduce the photographs from the film, but chooses different images, and in turns, in his words, invents a new documentary fiction that questions the double reality of life in the banlieue in the making of a film. And speaking about the photographs taken during the shooting of the film, Hate, Favier adds that the photographs have no captions. They invent in the space of the book yet another fiction in dialogue with that of the film itself. The documentary aspect is also used in many other films, you know, sort of, I'm thinking of Kechiche's Games of Chance and Love, which is an interesting remake of the Marivaux, and also Laurent Conté's The Class, that, you know, where The Class produces its own film. And so the effort seems to be in a lot of this fiction and in a lot of these films to bring in the people rather than speak for them. The important part is that there is nobody who is looking at, but everybody is kind of on stage, if you like, or everybody is part of this process. The process of putting oneself on stage, of speaking with, and of letting others speak, as well as a renewed emphasis on translation and negotiations, also leads to the resurgence of a certain militant theater. Often communally created with a plurality of voices, this collective theater replaces the classical stage with another space that frequently includes the public. And here we can mention Hélène Cixous, The Purchased City, but even more so, and here is Water, Drums on the Dam. And in the best of all worlds, I would have talked about dams and water. She focuses on ecological problems of nature and habitability that loom large in Asia with the impending flooding of the Three Gorges of the Yangtze River in China, but also others in Vietnam and Korea. At the limit, we could also include Julia Kristeva's Thérèse, Mon Amour, a Baroque 750-page tale of Teresa of Avila that travels across centuries and genres, written at the intersection of biography, autobiography, epistolary exchanges, philosophy, theatrical dialogue, musical annotations of opera, photographs, sculpture, and paintings. The fictionalized history consists of a braiding of multiple voices with no return to a world outside of itself. These writers, filmmakers, theorists, philosophers address dilemmas that are local as well as transnational and even global. They cannot be subsumed under the banner of an earlier universal humanism or of a national republic of letters. They recognize that the world consists of different, even conflicting universalities that all make up and redefine contemporary French culture. Distinct from Francité, this new Frenchness, if we still want to call it that, is based on contingencies and ongoing transformations rather than timeless values. Aware of elaborating new ways of being in common in a densely populated country and world, these writers and artists are working in and from different networks. Bending genres and crossing disciplines, they reevaluate and re-elaborate to the tradition of French universalism. In addition to the movements of people, they are keenly aware of the encroachment of economic globalization with the power of the media, but also of what becomes of the world implemented by electronic technologies. Far-reaching consequences affect the nation-state along with traditional notions of politics and culture. Today, as Jacques Derrida and many others have argued, humans leave the world of print culture for that of information and electronic technologies. In an interview with Paul Virilio, Friedrich Kittler responds to his French interlocutor, who laments the death of mankind with the advent of teletechnologies, by pointing out quite simply and tersely that it is not so much the death of humans as of culture and politics as we know them. What in such a climate will remain not only of national literature, but of literature tout court? Whether literature, a term coined in 1802 by Madame de Stael, when we change our rapport with the age of print culture? What will remain of film, a medium of the 20th century and the 21st century? Will they simply be classified in the annuals of a blogosphere and a myriad number of Facebooks and YouTube? What of theory? To put it in a less extreme way, in the parlance of Deleuze and Guattari, can literature and film continue to resist and create? You occupy the street rather than, as in the age of state thought, hold the fort. For our purposes, the question can be rephrased. Can a reassessed French literature and culture continue to open spaces from which to rephrase burning questions or simply to think otherwise? Jacques Rancière, a writer always keen on meditating on the relation between politics and aesthetics and on establishing la part des sans-parts, the portion of the portionless, ponders the question in relation to art. In a recent interview in Art Forum, March 2007, he asks what art can do. We can adapt his question by changing Sartre's earlier qu'est-ce que la littérature, what is literature, to what can literature do, que peut la littérature, what is its power, its puissance. With an advent of media culture and the digital age, can we still continue to believe in the power of literature and not only in literature as fantasy? We have seen how the scope of French literature has been extended to include various and diverse cultural fictions. We can mobilize for our purposes Amartya Sen, quoted by Balibar, to say that these new writerly, filmic, or theoretical fictions open new spaces by expanding the reader's and the viewer's capacity as subjects and as citizens. We can also go back to a question we had raised earlier. In an age ruled by technology and globalization, are these fictions simply little white pebbles in a deep sea of technology, as Certeau put it a few decades ago? In answer, let us turn once more to Deleuze, who insists on the necessity and importance of opening vacuoles, or microspaces, in the everyday that will enable us to think otherwise. It is not a question of going back to a vanishing everyday of yesteryear or of seeking refuge in a rarefied literary spaces as in the 1960s, but rather of inventing other ways of being in common from today's conditions, conditions that include large cities, migrant populations, and technologies that demarcate generations of populations from one another. We can invoke two, Hélène Cixous, who reshaped Beckett's dying words in her book, Le Voisin de Zéro, Sam Beckett, the neighbor of Zero, Sam Beckett, when asked what he had learned from life. The writer, whom Deleuze called the greatest Irish poet, answered, "Precious little." This is perhaps what remains of literature, film, and theory, precious little. It may be little, but it is precious. It is still capable of opening spaces and of enabling travel, as well as translation and negotiation between communities. more and more with the help of technologies in an effort to create common national, European, and world spaces. It neither legitimates a national culture, nor does it signify universal transcendental values. Rather, by calling into question, as Rancière would have it in a slightly different context, and I quote, divisions and boundaries, high culture and popular culture, representation and the unrepresentable, the modern and the postmodern, to point to the configurations of possibilities, a perception of the multiple alterations and displacements that make up forms of political subjectivation and artistic invention, unquote. Literature, theory, and film, if we want to keep these distinctions, undo the boundaries defining heretofore certain practices. In their own fashion, they do away with earlier aesthetic constraints and make possible the opening of passages and the creation of new meanings that are far from the reductive constructions of the dominant media, as well as from the earlier disciplinary boundaries and homogenizing effects of national languages and literatures. Like other fields, such as anthropology and sociology, literature is being hybridized. It comes in smaller texts or casings and in magnetic or digital coding, and rarely as pure works of art or writing. It comes often in mixed genres or as ephemera, critical essays, documentaries, and CD-ROMs or web projects. It circulates along electronic networks, produced by heterogeneous groups of writers, theorists, and filmmakers from France, from its ex-colonies, and from other European or other countries. It is received less as a national product than as an array of novel productions. These hybrid forms explode a former narrowly defined national meaning. They open new spaces for novel connections and thus, in their own ways, realize things French that have now become truly global. Thank you.
We'd like to hope to invite you to reception, but first we have ample time for questions or discussion.
Yes.
I'm wondering if you would consider a written work like Pierre Bourdieu's Misère du Monde, like the Le Bel film.
I must confess that not because I don't want to, but I don't know Bourdieu. You know, I mean, every time I give a talk on whatever topic, people ask me Bourdieu, and it's really one of my, it's on top of my to-do list. I don't know. I should. I really should, because it's, yeah.
Because that's an unusual one in the sense that that is one in terms of overturning sociological work in which he does bring in all the terms that you've used, especially too in the sense of there's a way he puts sociology on stage. And it is quite interesting what he does and how all of these French problems are made to be problems of globalization or are made to be more problems of that are world problems, but also in the way in which the interlocutor is a midwife that brings out the speech in this way. So very much all the things that you were talking about, it's a pivotal work. It's not like the others. It's quite different.
What's the title?
It is La Misère du Monde.
La Misère du Monde. Yeah, I'm very ignorant, and thank you for bringing this to my attention. If I had done my homework, and I realized rereading this, you know, how many repetitions it still has and stuff, but I it would have been helpful if I had some PowerPoint, actually, because, for example, the something that's, if you look at Latour's book on Paris, Bamba Nizi, which is a catalog, it's huge. I would have brought it, but I had to walk 21 minutes. And it's a big thing, and that precisely asks the question, what is the social? And it's beautifully done, but then if you go to the web project, the web project is amazing. And so it hybridizes not only the discourse, because what is this Bahia-Zibu in Paris Invisible City? It's been translated too long. All you have to do is type in the web, Paris Invisible City, and it will pop right up. It's just beautiful. And I teach it every once in a while. The students love it. You know, it's just.
This is translated because the weight of the world. They tried to keep the.
Oh, is that what they do? Okay. Well, thank you for pointing that out.
What is interesting regarding this book is first that it was one of the only sociological or sociology bestsellers in France.
Yes.
And also that indeed moving away from all the tradition that Bourdieu himself had tried to found, it's a book not about society but about, you know, atoms.
Uh-huh.
It's only, I mean, there's no society anymore in this book. If you read it, it's only a kind of interviews with people. Of course, they are situated within a certain social context, but all in all, the picture you get from society is not the kind of macro picture you can get from the rest of Bourdieu's sociology. So there is no more social literature.
Well, that's a little bit Latour's argument too, since I mean, his argument has to do with the what he calls the cascade d'images. And a cascade, if I'm not mistaken, is a term that comes from physics, right? And not from water here. So it's all these things that kind of collide and that only stabilize themselves when you frame them. And you can frame them in an image or you can frame them with words in a certain expression, but his argument isn't. And, you know, it's open to debate that the world is constantly moving. Everything is in constant movement. And so what stabilizes it is when we say something, when we use an expression, or when we frame the image. And of importance is what gives meaning, finally, is the way we align some things and how do we align images, how do we put them together. And that is how meaning is produced. So it sounds like it's similar because they are two. He wants to get away from actually what I was doing here, because I said at the beginning, I'm going at a very high altitude. And it's wrong because that's precisely the kind of overview that you want to avoid. Autocriticism.
Yeah. I was wondering. I mean, the early part of your talk, you were stressing the importance of writers from elsewhere who have transformed the French literary cultural scene and the move from universalism to exploration of different kinds of national ties and hybrid identities, etc. But then, and then at the end, with your questions about que fait la littérature and where is it going, you shifted from that to this vision of hybridized text and things circulating in different ways. I mean, I'm wondering about that because it does seem to me that despite the transformation of the French literary scene, it's still a place in comparison with other countries anyway, where there is a very substantial and systematic production of novels and literary works of a traditional kind, along with certain experiments. And I guess I don't have the sense that. But it may just be that I don't log on to the right sites. That France is this website with all these different genres, etc. There's still all the books that look like novels in the bookstores. And still a lot of bookstores.
It's very funny that you mentioned that because I think they just gave away the Prix Goncourt, and I just saw it online. And they have this really stealthy picture of
this people receiving a Goncourt.
It's like, where am I in this?
And
an Afghan.
Non-native
speaker of French, which is interesting.
That's right.
That's what marks the French scene, that these other writers are, but it's still the Goncourt, there's still these novels, it's just hybridized.
I'm totally with you. I know. But let me say that I was talking about possibilities. And
possibilities.
So Patrick Duval came to give a talk and he said, you must lean forward. So I was leaning forward, trying to push it in the direction in which I wanted it to go. No, I know fully well how traditional it is in many ways. Though you're right, I mean, the Goncourt was given to this Afghan writer.
And John Little 2 years ago.
That's right.
Those
however,
there is this too. Mm-hmm. And I mean, if you look even at some of Demeter's question of technologies, I mean, he very clearly says that we are getting out of this world of, you know, of print culture and where are we going. So don't forget, I mean, literary history is not really my thing, but don't forget that I was really doing this to for a, you know, for specific volume, mm-hmm. for a specific topic. However, I personally am very interested in this kind of hybridization, and I think that the dichotomies that are established by somebody like Paul Murillo, you know, are unfair, unfortunately, really, because it doesn't show the productive aspects of this technology. I mean, it's not just that we have to jump on the bandwagon, but if you look, for example, and now I really am sorry I didn't do my homework. If you look at Lactulo's catalog from Paris, which is beautiful, it's just beautiful. But then if you look at the web project, I mean, it's fantastic. And so you can really have, you know, you do all, I think as we go on, and there I'm going on a little bit, as we go on, I think more and more these projects are going to be hybridized. And so if you look at Kristeva's website for her Thérèse Davila, Thérèse Mon Amour, which is actually a very good book, it's huge. I had to read it for the translation, and it's really very productive, multimedia everywhere. And her website has all kinds of music and painting, and I told them they should have a CD-ROM go with the translation, because it would be for students who are looking at that and who are opening this up, it would 700 pages, that's a hard read, a hard sell. But if you have something that, you know, colors and sounds, and I think we should think in terms of enhancing things, not taking away. So, but there, I'm totally agree with you. Yes. And I think, I was thinking at the time, when I actually started doing this a year ago under extreme duress, and then I had to pick it up for the last 2 weeks again. And I was thinking, too, that there's this woman who writes this, La République des Lettres, what's her name?
Casanova, Pascal.
Yeah, Pascal Casanova. Yeah.
You know, I find it very conventional in terms mm-hmm. of what she does. And mm-hmm. so I think that had been in the back of my mind, too. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you always work out of a context, as Marie-Claire said, yeah, context. And so there was a context there where I was addressing mm-hmm. certain things. Sure. But I think that some fantastic things are being done in France, actually, and they're very, very media savvy mm-hmm. in many ways. And I think the whole Latour project that he has online is fabulous. It's you know, with art and print and text and mm-hmm. the whole works. So, so I have too much going on. I mean, I know. Yes.
Since you've been talking technology and about this notion that the state would be unraveling to some extent or changing in nature following this Balibaran argument, I was wondering about this the evolution of the plot regarding the digital library in France, you know, the project initiated by the French Bibliothèque Nationale. Mm-hmm. Under its former director, Jean-Luc Jeannet, a project which is still thought of as a rival project of Google Books or the like. And I recently read that this project now, it's supposed to be European, you know, but it's the name is Gallica, so it's mm-hmm. very still. And I read right this afternoon in my email that.
I
mean, Gallica is usually, originally, that's why it's Gallica, it's originally the name of the numerite of the digitalized collection mm-hmm. from the Bibliothèque mm-hmm. Nationale de France. But now that they're speaking about the European level, they still mm-hmm. call it Gallica, which is very strange. And I mean, I read something, I received an email about the instructions that publishing houses mm-hmm. have been receiving mm-hmm. regarding how to transmit the kind of compulsory duty they have to forward copies of the books to as a form of dépôt légal for the digitalization. It seems to be something very, very contested, because there also is a kind of private company handling all the business. So, I mean, this question of how the here, I mean, regarding exactly another side of the production of literature as a public object, a public patrimoine, like form, and its privatization or under a monopoly of the state. I think it's. I was wondering what you would have regarding this side of the transformation of the literary national Frenchness, so to speak.
Right. What specifically is the question?
Well, this idea of the while literature is being among others digitalized, you have still this reassertion of the French state control over this notion through the very technology and I mean, what do you have any ideas about this aspect? I was just curious. But.
Yeah, sure. I can see that. No, I don't. I mean, maybe in a couple of hours I will, but right now. But you know, I mean, that's the kind of interesting part. Is precisely that centralization that is still there, and the attempt to centralize everything that is still there. At the same time, that it is also. At a certain level, and maybe at another level, it is exploded.
I'm very convinced, actually, by the model that you propose, just as I test it, against my own recent experiences of French culture. And I'm thinking, for instance, I recently watched the other Laurent Conté films again, Human Resources and Time Out. They're both such intensive studies of French or Francophone European culture. Mm-hmm. Yet that are also about globalization, you know, by revealing these structures that you can read inside the films the same way that you would work with a digital photograph, in this case not through being able to reconstitute the way you describe, but also but by being able to find, you know, such detail and such a rich optical unconscious in the digital photograph. And I'm wondering two things. The first thing I'm wondering is whether or not, Mark is hinting at this, there isn't like a deeper legacy of this move toward unpacking intensity as characteristic of this kind of French culture, so that Cixous could be characteristic of this, you know, with like her intense focus on Beckett or Clarice Lispector, mm-hmm. her authors, right? Mm-hmm. So she's almost parodying the Republic of Letters model by, you know, by building this World Republic of Letters of like her handful of authors.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
And then the last thing I just wanted to ask about is just the language of the semantics of the monde, mondialisation, however you say globalization in French, as distinct from globalization, whether there's even a semantic level of kind of worlding and world making that's happening that gives a different spin to this whole process in that context.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I mean, I think that in the you know, when Cixous and some of these other people in the 60s were really, and I mean, you contradict me if you don't think so, but I do think that they were among the first to kind of denationalize literature and denationalize it because they were so critical of national literature. You know, that was really a kind of world literature and focus on poetics rather than on national and literary histories of the nation. And I think I went to school, and so I was caught between the literary history in when I was a little girl, and it was unbelievably boring.
Yeah,
and then suddenly
the
poetics came in and it opened up, you know. But then physically, I think, you know, if you look at, you know, the I was struck, I mean, by the emphasis in Europe on national literature still now. And I think, you know, I don't think it's going to last, I mean, personally. I think though we have the Goncourt, and though we have this, and though we have that, I mean, look at it, it's European, and it's everything. That's one thing. The other thing is that actually France has always been open to many more literatures than maybe America has, because you've always had a lot of translations. And, you know, some of the gripe that I had is maybe American curricula of Francophone literature that always separates the Francophone from the French. I mean, we have all the PhD qualifying, we have French literature of the 20th century, and then Francophone literature. So I'm like, what do you mean? I mean, this is part of the other stuff. But anyhow, so they always had that, but it's slightly different today because with all these, you know, I mean, you have this population pressures nonetheless, and so I think the when you distinguish, you have also these transnational ties, and you know, something that is not elaborated on all that much, but even within European countries, some of these transnational ties are more and more numerous, and so whom do you address and where do you situate yourself? I think that's it. The other thing I think that is interesting is that with the global age, you have also return to the local, and that's really interesting. And in all terms, local technologies, even, I mean, that's not in my paper here, but there is that return to the local at the same time that, you know, everything is so, so global. So.